Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. In this episode, I talk to Amanda Knox about her wrongful conviction for the murder of Meredith Kircher. Her experience revealed dark truths about the media's inclination to over-sensationalize stories about young women and the glaring human errors in the criminal justice system. We also touch on the topics of trauma, cancel culture, cognitive biases, law, and forensic science. Throughout this episode, I try my best to show the audience the real Amanda Knox, not the version of her that the media has depicted. Along those lines, I give her some of my psychological tests to take, including my test on self-actualization, as well as my psychopath test. You won't want to miss the results or this episode. It's a really powerful episode, and I think you'll get a lot out of it. So let's get right into it. I bring you Amanda Knox. Amanda, how are you doing today? Thanks for being on my podcast.
I'm doing great. I'm a little sleep deprived, so you'll have to excuse my sleep deprived brain, but I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Well, does it have anything to do with the fact that you just had a new baby girl?
Oh my God, yes. We were awake last night for a little bit together, just wandering around the house until she fell asleep again. So that's my world right now.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
To the birth of Eureka Muse Knox Robinson.
Yeah,
congratulations.
Thank you.
You know, there's a specific reason why you decided to tell the story of and kind of to lead people on the journey, you know, tell people about your journey, right? You wanted to kind of control the narrative in a way. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, so yes, the issue that I faced from the second I got pregnant was the idea that my pregnancy and the birth of my child would, like every other private aspect of my life, be deemed in the public interest and therefore not protected by privacy laws, and that the tabloids would exploit those very intimate parts of my life to defame me and harm me psychologically. So I decided that I would try to disincentivize their coverage and their sort of impulse to go after me with paparazzi by, first of all, keeping the pregnancy journey and the birth journey to myself until I was ready to tell it and to tell it in my own way, so that at the very least, when people did first hear of my daughter's existence, it would be in the context of something that was exploring these difficult positions that I'm in and the sort of position that I hope my daughter will be in the future, which is to not be treated just like the latest scandal content in the Amanda Knox saga, as Tom McCarthy so aptly put it.
Well, look, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So I'm a scientist here, and I really do extensive preparation for all my guests, and you were certainly included in that. And what just boggled my mind were some of the things that people would just say online with no factual support whatsoever to it. And not only that, but there are various things I got like really into the case in like a really scientific way, like you know,
the best
with
way.
Just no cart, yeah, no cart in the horse sort of way. Mm-hmm. You know, I was like, what is the evidence? Just and I would really and I would wake up in the middle of the night actually. At one point, I was like, oh, what about this? And I would go and I would do an extensive Google search. I was like, oh, okay, that answers that for me. Yeah, okay, I get it. But then I would still see things propagated over and over again. How do you have so much grace in handling that? Because I noticed you don't even respond to something. Like, I wanted to fight for you.
Yeah.
Some people respond on my own Twitter page. I want to be like, are you serious? Like, you didn't even look at this like objectively whatsoever.
Yeah, it's a good question, because I feel like you have the same impulse as my husband. My husband is very, very protective of me and deeply, deeply offended whenever anyone makes a false claim about me online and vilifies me. And he's just like so outraged by it. He's like, of all the people in the world, why you? Like, of all the people. And my relationship with it is a little bit different, in part because I spent so long not being able to defend myself at all. I was in prison for 4 years between the ages of 20 and 24 when this was first happening. And I had very, very little opportunity to defend myself at all. So I wonder if, in part, I internalized some feelings of helplessness or hopelessness. I also feel like the sort of mental state that I was in that time period was one in which I realized that, oh, wow, for so many people, the truth doesn't actually matter. Just the story matters and the characters of that story matter, whether or not they correspond with reality. And the story that I was telling myself about my own life, like what I could expect from life, like go to school, find love, have children, have a career, like those were all things that were also stories that I had been telling myself. And there had been no guarantee that that was actually going to be the course of my life. And so in the prison environment, I very much suddenly realized that there were no guarantees in life, and I had to instead be very present with what I did have, be very like aware of what I did have. And I didn't have much, so I could catalog it. And then since coming home, it's a little bit different because the prison and trial experience is one in which absolutely what people are saying about me out in the world very, very much impacts my right to live as a free human being in the world. But once I was exonerated, I realized that the game had changed. It was no longer about my freedom. It was about my identity. And that was the thing that remained the missing piece of my life that had been stolen from me. But like, my freedom and my identity are two very different things. I can live with myself and my identity in my small world and also understand that, like, I don't actually have full control over my identity in the greater world. That doesn't, like, it does impact me, but it's not the same as someone trying to put me in jail. So I guess it put that into perspective.
Yeah, it sounds like you became got a PhD in psychology informally throughout this whole process.
Right. Actually, a lot of psychologists say that to me, where they're like, wow, some of the strategies that you used to get through that experience are strategies that we try to like therapists will share. Like one of the strategies that I had, which I wouldn't even consider a strategy, I sort of intuitively did it, was I had conversations with my younger self about what she was going to experience in the future. So in a way, I was sort of big sister coaching myself through the experience in order to feel like less powerless over it. Like, and so it sort of like took a thing that felt very much on top of me and I put it in front of me and I sort of disassociated from it a little bit. And that helped me at the very least get through the day.
But see, that's textbook. So for instance, George Bonanno, but you didn't know it, that's textbook psychology. You just devised it. But George Bonanno, who was recently on my podcast, actually highly recommend listening to our chat. He just wrote a book called The End of Trauma. Mm. It's all about he's one of the leading researchers on resiliency. Mm. And he's really shown that self-talk is a major, major strategy. He has a whole chapter on self-talk in his book. Mm. So that's really cool for you to hear that. He's like just two episodes ago or something.
Can you describe to me what he means by self-talk? Because I'd be curious to know if it has to do with the narrative of one's life that one either feels they have control over or they don't have control over. I'd be interested to know that.
I think he's more referring to it in the extent to which you tell yourself that you have deep reservoirs of resiliency that are untapped, that you can handle this. Mm. You know, saying, just even saying words to yourself. You know, researchers have looked at the difference between just saying to yourself, I can do this. You know what? I've faced hard things before. You know, there will be a future versus thinking to yourself, this is it. You know, like there's no hope. You know, there's a very, very strong statistically significant difference between those two conditions.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that that squares with my own experience because I even would think to myself at certain times, I went through soccer training a lot when I was a kid. And one of the things that I told myself to get through the very difficult soccer practices occasionally was I would just do the little engine that could mantra over and over my head. I think I can. I think I can. I think I can. And the thing I really loved about that was the uncertainty. I was like, I think I can. I'm not sure, but I'm going to try. I'm going to try to get through this day. We'll see.
I love that. Well, by the way, that's where you got the nickname Foxy Knox. You probably never want to hear that nickname ever again. Oh. But just for the record, this is helpful for you. For the record, you got that nickname because what you kind of like, you played soccer like a fox, like you were like,
yeah. So I, you were good. I mean, good? I was, yeah. So I was one of the smaller players and I was very quick. Mm. And I was, I played this position called top of the diamond, which is the first line of defense. And it's a position where you're constantly squirreling around or to try to steal the ball away from people. So in that way, and my name rhymes with Fox. So that's how that came about.
I want a cool nickname.
Right?
I want a better one. I want a better one than what they called me around your age. When I was that age, they called me Scotty Potty.
Oh, no. Is so there an incident or was it just because it rhymed?
No. Okay, no, no. I'll tell you. I'm a little bit older than you, mm-hmm. Amanda, but not by that much. But there was something called the Sour Patch Kids cards.
Cards?
Back in the day. Have you ever heard of the Sour Patch Kids?
I mean, I've eaten many a Sour Patch Kid, but I did not know that they came with cards.
I believe they had cards, and one of the names of one of them was Scotty Potty.
Oh.
So that was one of the Sour Patch Kids. I'm pretty sure, maybe I'm messing up my 80s references. It was called something else, but there were these cards, and they were a whole collection of these funny things. But anyway,
are you thinking of the Garbage Pail Kids?
Yes,
Okay. Because I was about to say, I think Sour Patch Kids just came in like
that's a candy. Yeah. That's a candy. You're right. Garbage Pail Kids. Well, see you. Okay, thank you. So you know what I'm talking
about.
Okay. Now I've been trying to change that narrative as an adult. I had a girlfriend who, out of her own volition, called me Scotty Too Hotty, and I was like, okay. Okay, I like that one better.
That I love that one too because it's not even Scotty Hottie. Like she took it to the next level. Like MC hammered
too
it.
Hottie,
it
was yeah.
That's great.
She was a great girlfriend. I just want to say for the record, I appreciate her very much. So here's a quote I found when I was listening to your very interesting interview with Joe Rogan. I thought could set a stage for what we can really get into today. You said, "I feel like I'm constantly trapped in a conversation with the fake version of me in people's minds that keeps getting recycled over and over again." That is, first of all, that is good writing.
Oh, well.
You're obviously a good writer. Second of all, that's very powerful. That is very, very powerful. And I think a lot of us can relate. I can relate to your story, you know, just being very young. I was in special ed and for an auditory disability I had, and I read about this a lot and I wrote about this in various of my books. But the point here is that I felt as though I was reduced to how other people decide to put a label on me. And I feel like there's a connection here to probably how you felt and probably still feel to a large degree where you want to be able to create your own identity. Aren't you allowed to create your own identity? And that's how I felt certainly as a child fighting my way. I had actually fought my way out of special ed, and then I fought my way into gifted ed, and then people still saw me as the special ed kid, and I was like, but I'm in gifted
ed
now.
What are you talking about? I'm literally taking different tests.
Does it ever change? Can it ever change? So this idea of how gestalt perceptions really influence deeply how we see people, not just, you know, from a purely visual psychology point of view, but from a human whole person point of view. It's amazing how it's like an optical illusion in a way. You start to get to the evidence, you start to talk to the real Amanda Knox, which by the way, I'm thinking of calling today's episode The Real Amanda Knox. Once you start talking to the real Amanda Knox, maybe people's gestalt will flip. But the point is, the media control that gestalt, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, what's really interesting about your situation is these are people who had direct access to you, right? Like the thing that failed you in your experience was the education system not really recognized. I mean, I already have like a whole, like my mom is a school teacher and I love her and she does incredible work. And I recognize that it's very, very difficult to be a teacher in this world. But I do have a problem with the education system where it seems like everyone is churned through this system that is very, very specific and doesn't actually acknowledge the different ways that people learn and the different skill sets that people have. It feels like this conveyor belt education. And if you don't fit this very specific like role, then people treat you like you're lesser. It's very interesting. And I think that maybe it's even more difficult. And I have a lot of compassion for people who find themselves being sort of misidentified in their own communities, because these are people who you know and love and care about. And they're the people who are determining who you are that doesn't match up with your understanding of yourself and with the evidence. In my case, it was thousands and thousands of strangers who had no access to me, who were determining who I was for the sake of some kind of like morality tale that they were trying to like not only sort of determine, like, you know, find us a scapegoat to pin all of their like horrible, you know, feelings about a terrible tragedy that occurred. But also they had like this, the thing about my case is that I became this sort of blank slate onto which people could make judgments about women and about sexuality. And very, very much there was like this morality tale being told about female sexuality where I was the stand-in for everything that people hate and fear, but also are intrigued about female sexuality.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think you wouldn't mind having your Monica Lewinsky moment in a sense where why aren't all the Me Too feminists jumping on this? Because it really, you know, when you really look at it and you're really honest, when people are really honest about what happened, you know, a lot of it had to do with your looks. Mm-hmm. You know, would the same thing have happened if it was just your boyfriend at the time, Raphael, mm-hmm. you know, who was convicted? There's a real gender and sort of how we treat beautiful people in our society.
Yeah. I mean, it's astonishing.
You know, there's a story here.
Yeah. I mean, it is astonishing because on the one hand, Meredith also was a beautiful girl and she was brutally murdered. And no one really paid attention to the person who actually brutally raped and murdered her. Like what was interesting about, and there's also like a sort of tinge of racism here where the person who actually did this was a young black man who was disenfranchised and all of the things. And because people at the time were like, well, obviously he just, you know, there's nothing interesting about him as a criminal. What's interesting in a criminal is a female who is a part of involved in a sexually motivated violent crime. So the media totally overlooked the facts of this case in order to pursue a scandalous, salacious story. And there are, you know, deep-rooted reasons for that.
Really deep. I mean, the more we keep digging, I'm saying, you know, you start to realize, whoa, because it's not just simply a morality tale. You could easily by the way, his name was Rudy Guede, mm-hmm. right? Yep. Was the one who murdered Meredith Kircher. So, and he had been found just a couple even days before in a nursery or something, broken and was found with a knife.
Yeah.
You know, and it was only his fingerprints that were found in the room where Meredith was murdered.
DNA,
so these are facts.
His DNA on her body. Like, yeah, he was. Yeah. It's interesting because the way that the media treated him as well is also weirdly off, where one, they sort of ignored him. And then whenever they made reference to him, at least in Italy, I'm actually not familiar with how they referenced him in the US and in the UK. But at the time, they always referred to him as Livoriano, the person from the Ivory Coast, which is really interesting because, yes, he was from the Ivory Coast, but from what I understand, he moved to Italy and lived in Italy with an Italian family from a young age. So he really was an Italian. He just happened to be born in the Ivory Coast, but like people just really wanted to associate him as like an other. And then once they associated him as an other, they just sort of sidestepped him and weren't really interested in the facts of his story, which is a young guy brought up in a family, but starts getting into trouble, starts breaking and entering, starts doing drugs, goes down this spiral of breaking and entering that results in the end with a brutal rape and murder. That story very, very much got overlooked. And it's one that's worth looking into because that stuff happens and we should try to stop that kind of stuff from happening. Anyway.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Had you ever encountered him before?
I had seen him around because he played basketball with the guys who lived in the floor below us.
Downstairs.
And so, he was around, but I don't think I even really knew his name until he was arrested. I remember, like, when I was in jail, I remember the moment I was in prison, I was watching the news, and they showed him being arrested, and they were like, you know, Rudy Guede day, blah, 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 arrested in Germany after fleeing the country. And I was like, holy shit, I recognize that guy. Yeah. That guy? Like, that basketball guy? That's the guy who did it? And then I kept thinking, oh, wow, thank goodness they found the person who did it. I'll be released now.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the reasonable assumption. Yeah. That's the reasonable assumption. Yeah, I watched an interview that was done with him where he said he first was attracted to you. And then Meredith was kind of like the backup, you know, sort gross. Of thing. So, I mean, I know. And, you know, he obviously, he had talked to Meredith before. Do you reckon he was there that day because of Meredith, or he just thought it might have been an empty house?
I think that he probably thought it was an empty house.
That's what I'm thinking too.
Yeah. It was the holiday weekend. It was understood that, like, I didn't know this, but apparently, you know, the Day of the Dead, the day after Halloween, is a very common time for Italian people to go and visit their families and spend time with their families. I didn't know that. But that was the reason why so many of my Italian roommates were gone. And I had just happened to be spending the night over at my very new boyfriend's house, who I knew of several days. And so I think that he went in there because he knew the house. He had seen it before. He was looking to break and enter and get some money, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay. So let's get a bit of a picture of Amanda Knox before this tragedy happened. Mm-hmm. So you wrote, you were a nerdy poetry and language student.
Yeah.
Correct me if all these things I'm saying are wrong. You were a non-drinker, a non-smoker. Your favorite pursuits included yoga and, quote, backpacking long distances with people I know. Your favorite films were Shrek and The Full Monty, and you liked the Beatles and reading Harry Potter books.
Yeah.
Is this all correct?
The only thing that I would say is I was an occasional drinker and an occasional smoker at the time, but I was not heavy in either of those situations. But I don't think I was ever a non-drinker. I went to parties. I went and had drinks with people, but I was not like strict about it. It wasn't out of control, nor was I strict about never having it.
Well, that's what you wrote on your MySpace page probably when you were like 14.
Oh, well, yes. Yeah. So, MySpace was a while ago.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So I get this picture of a young girl who was just like really curious about the world, really innocent in a way. There's I sense a sort of innocence to you, you know, a sort of like naivete, how do you say it?
Naivete. Yeah. I think that would be accurate. I was the kind of person who really did well in school, never really got into trouble, was, you know, I worked a number of jobs to like save up money. Like I was a soccer coach for a young girls team. And I was also very like romantically and sexually inexperienced. So I was definitely like a late bloomer, kind of dorky musical theater Ren Fair kind of individual.
Really?
Yeah.
You were in a musical theater?
Oh, I love musical theater.
I was an
opera
major.
You were?
Oh, me too.
That is so cool.
I was a voice major at Carnegie Mellon. My dream was to be Javert in Les Mis.
That is amazing. I love opera, and I don't have the voice for it, but man, so much respect. Mm.
Well, you could be trained. I think anyone can be trained, honestly.
Do you ever sing anymore?
I do.
Awesome.
And I try to take lessons every now and then. Sometimes I even record something just with this microphone and kind of karaoke music, like from Stars from Les Mis in the background.
Yeah.
I posted it on my Twitter before.
Oh, yeah, cool. So. Yeah, I was in choir, so it's definitely not opera, but I was in choir and I love doing musical theater.
Right on. You know, my heart really breaks in so many ways for this story. But one way is that I really can resonate with studying abroad. Mm. You know, when I was about 24, 25, I went over to England, to Cambridge. And I just remember that what it was like. I remember, you know, everyone like awkwardly having sex with each other, everyone drinking we're all away from home for the first time. There really is an innocence there. Mm. The last thing you would ever
imagine. You know, people say things like, well, why wasn't she more, you know, affected, you know, outside? Why is she kissing? Look, it's not like the first thing you assume, you know, is in your worldview. You know, your worldview was literally, as psychologists call it, a seismic earthquake. That's what they call it in the post-traumatic growth literature, which is, I'm working on my next book on post-traumatic growth. So this topic is really front and center in my mind right now. And there's a whole assumptive world theory that I think might really interest you if you want to look at that literature.
Tell me more about the seismic eruption.
Earthquake. Yeah. Sorry. I mean, it's it's tied to this idea of assumptive world theory where we have these traumas. And I like to define trauma very broadly as anything, any event, because who am I to say, oh, that counts as a trauma or that doesn't count as a trauma, right? Like, who am I to say that? It's in a lot of ways, trauma is in the eye of the beholder. And any event that causes this complete cognitive restructuring of, oh, I thought the world was safe.
Yeah.
Where basically your basic assumptions of the world are violated.
Yep.
And this happened to you in a span of like an hour.
Yes.
You know? And people are like, oh, why didn't she act more normal? Like there's any normal way to act when your entire assumptive world has been violated.
I really appreciate you actually saying that because it's something that I've had a really hard time explaining to people. Like, I did not go home that morning to take a shower knowing that I was going to come across a crime scene. And even when it was made apparent to me that there was a crime scene, I had this like real, it was so surreal to me that I felt a little bit like disembodied. Like, what is happening? And also, am I certain what's happening? Because everyone's yelling in Italian. Like, it was so, so bizarre that I had trouble processing the experience. And, you know, a lot has been made of my behavior in those days. There's that footage of Raffaele and I outside of the house waiting for the police to tell us to go into the police station. And he kisses me. And the amount of times that that moment of him just sort of like trying to do what he could, which was just kind of hold me and kiss me and tell me I'm going to be okay. Like how that was twisted and distorted in the media into like, oh my God, she's such a sex fiend that she can't even keep her hands off him outside of a murder house. It's like, what is happening? Anyway, so
that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And to be clear, I mean, at that moment, that's, if we double click on that precise moment, it's not like you opened the door and you saw what was inside the door.
I did not. Right? No.
And I think people assume that as well. Just so many assumptions. I'm angry in the name of science. I'm angry at, you know, I'm also angry as the human dimension to it. But I'm saying, even if you take that out, someone's like, don't be biased, Scott. I'll be like, no, my point is there's so much evidence to contradict so many of the bullshit that's going around, and that, and I can't stand that when there's a propagation of bullshit that really bothers me.
Oh gosh, yeah. It's man, how do you live with the propagation of bullshit? Like, you have to take a deep breath.
So everywhere in this world right now.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, and the way I think about it is like, okay, there is the propagation of bullshit, but why? Like, why is it that the bullshit resonates with people? Because it wouldn't be propagated if it didn't resonate with people. And so that's a deep question that I keep asking myself. Like, why is the idea of a whorish murderer so much more compelling to people than the idea of just a regular human female who didn't have anything to do with this and was very, very confused and scared in the days leading up to her arrest? Like,
you know, I've just been thinking, there's a general phenomenon here that no one's ever really talked about in open, honest discourse. But if you look to see what some of the most popular porn is, it's degrading beautiful women, you know?
Interesting.
There's something there that I think there should be more research on. I'm not saying I know the final answer. I understand what's deep beneath it. But even my mentor, I've never met, but my mentor, in the sense, my intellectual hero, Abraham Maslow, wrote a whole essay on pornography in the 1560s. And by the way, I'm not anti-pornography in general.
No,
don't
neither
get me
am
wrong.
I, no.
I'm no prude, but I'm just noting a psychological phenomenon that even Maslow noticed in the 50s and 60s. He said, there's something where we elevate our self-esteem by getting back at all those women who rejected us, all those beautiful women. There might be something there.
Yeah, you know, I actually think that there is something there. And I would love to look in. I want to ask my dominatrix friends about this.
I was actually going to bring that up.
Because it's interesting because it's the flip side. But that flip side only exists because I think there's that predominant, like, let's punish the beautiful woman. And I do feel like I have myself, like, had to sort of get over that icky feeling that maybe one of the reasons why the police were going after me was because there was this weird sort of pornographic interest in me. Like, I had this, like, weird feeling, like, are they just focusing on me because, like, they have weird sexual feelings towards me that they don't know how to, like, deal. Like, when they say things like, oh, I had a gut instinct that she was guilty, it's like, did you or did you have a dick instinct? Like, what's going on here?
Yeah. Look, absolutely. And there's another injustice here, which is a complete misrepresentation of the BDSM community. Mm-hmm. And this really upsets me.
Yeah. I have a whole episode in my podcast Labyrinth about this. Did you listen to it?
I listened to it. I wanted to bring this up. Can you tell a little bit about your experience at DomCon? Did you have fun?
I loved DomCon. So my experience with DomCon was that at the time I was exploring this idea, like, what is up with this idea about a sex game? Like, why was that so titillating to people? What even is a sex game? And also, like, do people who take part in sex games, how do they feel about the way that their sort of world was represented in my case and vilified in my case? And so I reached out to the premier dominatrix ever, who, like, came up with DomCon, Mistress Cyan, and what I found,
a legend,
and this, like, amazing person who survived cancer and have done, like, so many amazing things. And I reached out to her and I was just like, hey, so I don't know if this makes me a creep or anything, but I just was wondering if you could tell me more about this world and what's going on there. And she was so warm and so kind and was like, you will be, like, just come visit, see for yourself. You'll be my special guest. I'll take care of you. I'll introduce you to people. And she really, like, just for over those days that I was there, I went to the New Orleans one, which was nicely small and sort of intimate, and everyone, like, there knew each other. It was really great. And, you know, clearly I was, like, exposed to new ways of thinking about even just not just sex, but about relationships. Like, my husband and I came away from that experience being like, you know what? We should have, like, codes of conduct and ways of communicating outside of the bedroom to determine, like, okay, in this world right now, we are going to, like, focus on each other and we're going to be really, really clear communicators with each other. But there are some times in life where I have to get work done and you have to be a second priority for me for this hour. And, like, we need to communicate that so no one's feelings get hurt and no one, you know, like, there's lots of ways that we miscommunicate with each other just because we're not being explicit about what our expectations are. And you can totally, like, do away with all of the hurt that can come from not being good communicators by just being more explicit about your expectations. So that was, like, my big takeaway. Not to mention I got flogged by Mistress Cyan, and that was really cool.
Well, hopefully there were no video cameras there.
There were not.
That's all you needed.
Yes. Yeah. And I was really terrified about that. But again, BDSM community, like, they are all about consent and they're not going to talk about your business without your consent. So good on them.
Yeah. Consent and, you know, there's care. There's care deeply intertwined with it. So I gave you a battery of psychological tests to take, and you were such a good sport.
Oh, they were
fun. You were
fun.
Such a good sport in taking these tests.
Yeah.
So let me reveal some of these results, and we can talk about them do you agree with them. So first is your top three sources of self-actualization are, the first one is continued freshness of appreciation. How has that played a role in your life?
I guess I feel lucky that whenever I encounter whenever I encounter something beautiful, I'm not bored. Like, even if I see the same, even if I listen to the same song that I really love, I still really love it. And I appreciate that I'm sort of built that way. So I I feel grateful that I feel gratitude for things and I don't take things for granted. So I think that that's a fair assessment. Oh, one thing I wanted to note before we go into these results is my husband disagreed with my results in many ways.
Can we bring him on? Can we bring him on?
Yeah, sure. He's just outside. I can wave him down. Hey, Boo, you want to come in?
I want to hear what he has to say. Now his name is Christopher Robinson. Right?
Yeah, here. I'll scooch over so he can.
I've been on the search for the perfect mattress for the past few years, and let me tell you, I've gone through so many mattresses. My friends have made fun of me because for so long I didn't actually own a mattress. I just went through so many free trials. I had no idea what it feels like to be well rested until I tried a Helix mattress. Are you not able to sleep because of stress and anxiety? It's definitely understandable given the current state of the world. Psychological research shows that high quality sleep is so important for stress and well-being though. Lack of quality sleep can affect your memory, increase mood swings, and even can lead to depression. While a number of factors contribute to poor sleep quality, your choice of mattress can really matter a lot. Helix Sleep makes personalized mattresses right here in America and ships them straight to your door with free, no-contact delivery, free returns, and a 100-night sleep trial. To choose a mattress, Helix made a quiz that takes just 2 minutes to complete and matches your body type and sleep preferences to the perfect mattress for you. If you like a mattress that's really soft or firm, you sleep on your side or your back or your stomach, or you sleep really hot, with Helix, there's a specific mattress for each and everyone's unique taste. Personally, I took the quiz and I was matched with the Helix Sunset Luxe because I wanted something that felt soft and I sleep mostly on my side all night. I've got to say, I love my Helix mattress. I wake up really feeling refreshed and ready to work out or start my work. Also, I've been tracking my sleep with a device, and my sleep score is consistently in the good or excellent range. This is a new thing for me, so it's really exciting to finally get high-quality sleep. I really do love Helix, but you don't have to take my word for it. Helix was awarded the number one best overall mattress pick of 2020 by GQ, Wired Magazine, and Apartment Therapy. Just go to helixsleep.com/psychology, take their 2-minute sleep quiz, and they'll match you to a customized mattress that will give you the best sleep of your life. They have a 10-year warranty, and you get to try it out for 100 nights risk-free. They'll even pick it up for you if you don't love it, but you probably will. Right now, Helix is offering up to $200 off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners at helixsleep.com/psychology. Get up to $200 off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows at helixsleep.com/psychology. That's helixsleep.com/psychology. Okay, now back to the show.
Hey, do you go by Christopher or Chris?
Hello.
Okay. Do you go by Christopher?
Chris or Christopher, either one.
Okay, cool. Hi, I'm Scott. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Scott.
So Amanda says you disagreed with some of her test results. We didn't get to the dark light triad stuff yet. I'm curious to see your thoughts on that. But so can you kind of hang around as I go through all the results with Amanda, and can you hear a dialogue between you two about it?
Sure.
Wait. Oh, I can't hear, but...
Yeah, well, here, there's another pair of headphones. So just get okay.
Get another pair of headphones because this is fun.
We have
so,
the technology.
Amanda, what I said to him is, you know, we'll go one by one and kind of have a dialogue here, what he thinks. Okay. So you tell me first whether or not you agree with it or not, and then I'll ask him.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
So you just talked about continued freshness appreciation. Do you agree, Chris? Do you agree about the very, very high? She scored actually 100%.
Yes.
100%.
That I 100% agree. Yeah.
And then the second one was truth seeking.
Yeah, I'm kind of a stickler for that, where I even to like my own chagrin or my own difficulties, where like I understand that sometimes the easiest way is to just say, you know, whatever, like that's true, that isn't true, it doesn't really matter, let's just move on. And I'm kind of a stickler for like, no, I want to know what's true. Like, what is really going on here? And I do that because I have a sense of responsibility towards the truth. And by that, I mean I have a sense of, I feel a sense of responsibility to humans. So I feel like truth seeking is a humanitarian thing for me, where if I am always, always looking for the truth, that means I'm always looking for the truth of the humanity of the subject that I'm interested in. And if I'm not willing to always be a stickler for the truth, that means that I may overlook the humanity of someone who I'm interacting with.
It's the weird moral dimension you have to truth seeking, whereas for me, it's more of a pure just a scientific pursuit sort of thing.
Right? Yeah, you're like more of like the principle of the thing.
I mean, she scored very high on truth seeking.
Yeah, no, I get that. She scored very high. Yeah, yeah, that was her second highest. The third one was interesting. Authenticity. Authenticity. How does that play out? And what does authenticity even mean? What does that mean to you?
Well, I think this might be in part due to the fact that I have, for the majority of my adult life, been accused of being something that I'm not. And I've been accused of being inauthentic and being a liar. And so it's become like I think I've overcompensated on the other end of that to be like, no, like, judge me all you want. Just judge me based upon the truth. And so if you're going to, if I'm going to give you the opportunity to judge me or anything else, like, here it is. Here, let me lay it all out for you. Like, I've got, and that has, but also at the same time, like, even when I was a kid, I wasn't like a person who, like, my mom tells this story about how, like, the one time I ever lied to her about something, she sort of didn't know what to do. Like, I was like six, maybe, and I lied about drawing a stick figure on the wall. And, and like, she was like, Amanda, did you do this? And I was like, no, no, no. And so she let it go for a half an hour. And then, like, a half an hour later, I came to her sobbing, like, I did it. I'm sorry.
Well,
I don't know.
That's kind of like what happened. That's kind of like what happened with you in the interrogation, is they pressured you so much, you signed something, but you felt such an overwhelming sense of this is not true that you wrote a letter. If I'm right, did you write a note to one of the head up detectives or something?
Yeah.
Being like, look, this wasn't true.
Yeah, yeah. They wouldn't listen to me. I wrote that note specifically because I kept saying, but can I talk to you again? Can I talk to you again? Please, what I said wasn't, I can't, I have to recant, like, blah, blah, blah. And they just were not interested. So I asked for a piece of paper to write it down. Yeah.
You just made me think of that, and it seems analogous in a way.
Yeah.
So yeah, right to the, so the next one, look, I'm not supposed to say the fourth one because it's the top three, but the fourth one is, so it was actually tied.
Oh.
Is it tied? Yeah, it's literally tied, and that's equanimity. And I think this one is very, very relevant to your whole life. You have mentioned that you sort of have a stoic sort of sensibility. People, when they said things like, oh, well, you didn't act how a normal person would act if someone, you know, this equanimity aspect to you in a way is what helped get you through so much of this, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like, trying to not just letting my emotions take over me, but letting them be information that I process. And I don't know, it's interesting because I used to refer to this as like deer in headlights syndrome, where I would just sort of like, when something happened, I would just be like, huh! And I would sort of need to process this, all this information, but I think equanimity is a nicer way of saying it.
I think her self-assessments on the sort of light triad things are
now we're going to get
mostly
to that.
Accurate, right? I think there's bit of,
but let's go through them. Don't spoiler alert. I feel like you're spoiler alerting this. And this is the most, this is what everyone came for, the popcorn. Your psychopath score, are you ready? Dun, 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 is extremely low. Extremely low. You are actually not a psychopath.
I try.
You are not a psychopath, according to my test. And you actually came out, quote, strongly tipped toward the light side. Strongly tipped toward the light side in my light versus dark triad test. Now, for my fellow nerds out there, I took a science. This is a scientifically valid test. This is not just like the Myers-Briggs, which isn't scientific. This takes well-validated dark triad research and my new construct, the light triad, and looks within her at all of these things, looking, mixing, matching to come out with an output. So the output is your strongly tipped to the light side. But let's go through each of the facets because they're super interesting.
Cool.
That your results. The first one is faith in humanity. This is the one fascinates me. And you scored very, very high in faith in humanity, which is believing in the fundamental goodness of humans. And you reminded me of an Anne Frank quote, which is in spite. So she wrote this in her journal as the Nazis were really coming up the stairs to kill her. She wrote in her journal, in spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart. So that's a direct quote from her journal. And you made me think of that. So Amanda, you still score high in faith in humanity in spite of everything. Can you kind of explain a little bit about that? How you feel about that?
I mean, I feel like I don't have evidence to point to necessarily. I just have an intuition that everyone is doing the best they can, even when they're not doing the best they can. Like everyone, I feel like if I put myself in the shoes of people who have made even like horrible, horrible decisions and terrible mistakes, the vast majority of the time, I don't believe that they're sitting there cackling about how evil they're being. I think that they're telling themselves a story about what they're doing, how they're doing it, how what they're doing is the right thing to do. And I think that what that means is that very often we are all making horrible mistakes and doing, you know, perpetrating lots of harm towards each other, but we're not doing it because we want to be hurting each other, which makes me think that like there is deep down a fundamental impulse for humanitarian. There is a fundamental humanitarian impulse in all of us.
The other side of that is like the moral luck question, which we explore. Was that in the One Bite of the Elephant episode?
Yeah, One Bite of the Elephant at a Time,
Do you know Thomas Nagel's moral luck thing?
Of course,
So, you know, even the, talking about the Nazis from a moment ago, like the whole question of, well, if that Nazi prison guard happened to be born in Argentina instead of Germany, would he have become that guy? You know, probably not, right? How much do those external twists of fate determine what our moral path is in life? And when you take that into account, especially neither of us believe in free will is another side of this. When you get rid of
free will, that's a whole conversation,
right? Then, you know, moral responsibility seems to go out the window in one light, but by the other light, no one's really morally culpable because you're just the little meat robot doing what you were programmed to do or through the vicissitudes of quantum fluctuations, right? Either way, it's hard to blame people and hate them for their actions, right? It actually leads to compassion, I think.
Yeah, I hear you. I don't know if we want to open that can of worms. I had a 4-hour two-part. Yeah. I highly recommend our listeners listen to my 2-part series with Sam Harris where we vehemently disagree about this.
Oh, interesting. We're going
to
check that out.
You guys may want to listen to that. Yeah. However, I read something in one of your blog posts I think is illustrates your own sense of compassion, even for Rudy Guede. So you had said that what you're angry about is that he just won't admit and you know, save a lot of people a lot of heartache and uncertainty and just, you know, that he just won't admit that he killed Meredith. However, you say, I doubt he ever will, but if the day he does, I will celebrate his rehabilitation and wish him the best on a new and honest chapter of his life.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting. I thought that it kind of speaks maybe a little bit to your instincts there for not defining anyone by their worst case, even Rudy.
Yeah. And I stand by that because I think the thing that anyone who has experienced harm most wants from the person who harmed them is an acknowledgement of the harm. Because at that point, I can say, all right, we at least are on the same page that what happened shouldn't have happened, and that I have been harmed, and that you are not sort of pretending that harm doesn't exist, or that what you did didn't cause direct harm to me. Because when someone doesn't like admit to the harm that they've caused, it makes the person who has been harmed feel, first of all, like they're being blamed for their own harm, but also it makes them feel unsafe. Like, oh, if you don't acknowledge what you've done, are you going to do it again? Like, if you didn't do anything wrong, well, then who's to say whether or not you're going to do it again? And so, like, that's the sort of key thing for me. Yeah. Like, people make mistakes and do horrible things all the time. That doesn't mean that it defines them, but what does matter from a trauma standpoint is the acknowledgement of the harm and of the action that caused the harm.
Yeah, I truly wish Rudy would do this someday. Yeah. Okay, so back to your dark triad score. So you score very, very low in psychopathy, as I already mentioned, which is callousness and cynicism. And then Machiavellianism, you score very, very low, which is strategic exploitation and deceit. You know, everyone knows the Machiavellian person. They're always scheming, right? They're always like, everyone knows that person. Every time you talk to them, they're like, oh, you know, if we move that chess pawn, then we can get this out of that person.
Right.
So you scored very low in that. That's not who you are, according to my test. However, however, this is the most, perhaps the most, we've been waiting. I saved this one for last because I suspected this is maybe where you two disagree. Your narcissism score was above average, was above it. Now, it wasn't 100%. It was approaching 60%, but it was greater than average by 12.45%, to be precise.
Yeah.
Now, what do you two think of that?
Yeah. So I think that I, because of how much my life has been, like, because I've been accused of things that I didn't do, I potentially have become someone who has been deeply invested in my sense of self. And I worry then that, like, has my narcissism been, you know, pushed up by, like, as a sort of trauma response, as a kind of like shield response to something. And I do worry about that. Mm. Now, Chris.
So,
you know, I want to hear what Chris has to say about this.
I think she's one of the most selfless, generous people I know, right? And I think one of the issues with any sort of self-reported test is you have your own cognitive blind spots towards your own behavior, tendencies to inflate good qualities or diminish bad qualities, et cetera. But also there's things like imposter syndrome.
He thinks that I have imposter syndrome.
I think Amanda has a deep, deep case of imposter syndrome. And that I think she has a big difficulty seeing her deeply positive traits, actually. And if you were to look at the DMs that come in, you know, of people saying, wow, you're such an inspiration to me. Like Amanda reads those and she's like, no, I'm not. You know, she doesn't believe that. Even if thousands of people are saying, wow, you're so strong and you really helped me change my life, that she doesn't believe that. She doesn't have that self-belief. So the idea that she's narcissistic and thinks that she's a savior for people, it's not the Amanda I see. And I'm actually, what are the, you know, it's better than we do. What are the questions
you took
that
the
relate
test
to
too.
That score?
Well, I certainly can't reveal that.
Oh, right. That would
because that's actually telling this. It's like saying, give me the IQ test items.
Right, and then, okay.
But there's an interesting link here between that. I'm going to send you an article I wrote in Scientific American on the link between a particular kind of narcissism and imposter syndrome. It's not the kind of narcissism that most people are aware of, but it's one that I've conducted research for the past decade about, and I've been trying to increase awareness about because it's the one that's most linked to psychopathology. And that's called vulnerable narcissism. Now, it makes me think now I want to give you my vulnerable narcissism test. But vulnerable narcissist. So most people, when they think of narcissism, they think of the grandiose narcissist, which is chest thumping, extroverted, Trump. Okay, right. So they think of the, you know, I mean, stereotypical, I'm great, right? The person that screams, I'm great. But, and this is something in my own healing process. So this is a very human thing. I don't believe in separating narcissists from not narcissists. I think we all have narcissistic tendencies, but a lot of people who have gone through trauma develop, and we found this, we've published papers showing that early childhood trauma and violation of expectations lead to a vulnerable kind of narcissism where the person feels shame all the time. But at the very, so shame is the number one marker of it. And we found, we were the first ones to publish a paper showing the linkage to imposter syndrome. So I'm actually going to send you, I'll make a note to send you that Scientific American paper.
And that makes sense. Like the idea that, like, you know, people are saying bad things and or like doing things to you and you think, oh, they're doing it because it's me and I'm, you know, they think I'm a bad person. And you're like, no, they're just doing their thing and it has nothing to do with you. And so you are being a little bit of a narcissist by thinking that people are being, you know, bad to you for whatever reason. Like, is that what you're talking about?
It's a smoke and fire thing a bit, I think, when the whole world tells you for years on end that you're an evil monster, right? I think it's hard for anybody to not go, is there anything there, you know?
Or, and also, but like, I think it's totally true that I'm guilty of this, where like, I when people are like out about in the world and I notice that they recognize me, I think, are they talking to me because they've heard of this horrible story about me? Or are they just talking to me because I'm happen to be getting mushrooms at the grocery store next to them grabbing a cucumber? Like, I do worry about that.
So this is exactly what I help my clients with. So I feel like I'm giving, do I slip into psychotherapy mode all of a sudden? but can I give you some advice just to help you with your healing, if I can in any way? The number one point of why vulnerable narcissism, like at the root of vulnerable narcissism, is an uncertain self-esteem. Hmm. Okay. There's literally there's an entire handbook called the Handbook of Uncertain Self-Esteem.
Okay.
There's a whole research field on this. I suspect that's what you're plagued with. Hmm. And if you could find a way of grounding yourself more with self-compassion exercises. I love Sharon Salzberg's loving kindness meditations. Mm. If you can just ground yourself with more of an inner presence that doesn't need to be validated by others, you know, where you don't lead with uncertainty about your self-esteem, but you lead with your authenticity that you already score high on. The more you can just lead with your authenticity, the less you'll feel these vulnerable narcissistic characteristics. Does that make sense?
Mm. Yeah, no, that's actually really great. And I think that does ring very true to me.
I mean, it's...
I'm almost getting sad.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean...
Yeah. There's hope here, but I'm saying there's hope.
A thing she's been grappling with ever since this Italy trauma has been... And it's something I think we talked about with LeVar Burton, actually, in that season one episode of Labyrinths, that Amanda worries that the most, you know, notable thing about her forever will be a thing that she didn't do and that happened to her. And most people don't have the opportunity to deal with that strange circumstance where the whole world associates your name and your identity and who you are and why you matter with this thing that has nothing to do with you. She often wonders, will I ever contribute to the world in any way that will matter more and that will have an impact more than this other thing that is not of me? And
I have a radical suggestion.
Please.
And this may sound like I've just slipped into Oprah mode, but I have a radical suggestion. Had it ever occurred to you that in this precise moment you're enough?
No.
Like, that's it. Yeah. I do feel like you're a truth seeker. Entertain that hypothesis for a second. You know, like, maybe this precise moment, it's like, oh, wait, I'm enough. Everything else is just gravy from here.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'll try that. I'll do a meditation on that today. Thanks.
Awesome. So, Chris, thanks so much for joining us for this.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. Amanda, do you have another 10, 15 minutes to talk about cognitive bias?
Oh, sure.
I want to be really respectful of your time.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to hop out and attend to baby.
Oh, is she awake?
Well, I'm just going to check.
Oh, okay.
Nice to talk to you.
Thank you, Chris. Nice to talk to you, too. Didn't expect it to go off in that direction, but I'm glad it did. I'm glad it did.
No, I appreciate it, too, because this is, I feel like yours.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. This is like an ongoing conversation between me and Chris, because like I've often been... somewhat astounded by like how confident he is in himself, in the sense that like, you know, the sort of things that would get me down, he's just like, well, I know that I'm a good writer and I know that I'm like a this, that, or the other. So I don't have to worry about whether or not the world is acknowledging that I am or not. And I struggle with that more, where I feel like I have to prove myself constantly. I'm not giving myself as much space to just prove myself to myself. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I hear you. But, you know, a lot of healing will come from feeling whole inner wise. Great. Well, so you've been really interested in cognitive bias.
I have,
and,
yes.
You learned a whole lesson. Now, you really wrote a nerdy blog post that you could probably submit to a scientific journal with this bias. And this, I mean, you gave, you know, did you hear Mike chat with Kahneman on this podcast by any chance?
No.
Have you listened to that one yet? You know, he's, Daniel Kahneman, obviously, one of the co-founders, leading researchers of the cognitive bias literature. Mm-hmm. But you had new ones that I had never seen before.
Well, I've gone down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, you did. Well, I appreciate it. You're in a safe, nerdy space here.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So you look, I thought this was really interesting. You literally coined a new bias that I think is really a good one, and it's called the single victim fallacy. Mm. Can you talk a little bit about what that is? Because yes. I think it'll blow people's minds because it almost doesn't dawn on people that it can be multiple victims in
yeah,
this situation.
Yeah, well, I think that just arises from these black and white narratives. But what I observed in my own experience was this false notion that if Meredith, the young woman who was raped and murdered, is a victim, then anyone else who is within the vicinity of the story cannot be a victim. And similarly, like if people say, well, Amanda's a victim, like people have treated this case as if I'm not a real victim, that there's a real victim and then there is me. And I wanted to point out, like, just because Meredith was the original victim in this case doesn't mean that there couldn't be other people who are victimized from this story. Mm. And I wanted to point out this like black and white thinking process where it's like there seems to be this sort of zero sum bias that like if there's victimization on my part, that somehow takes away from the victimization on Meredith's part. And I want to point out, like, that's absolutely not true. But I continually have that thrown at me constantly by people online who say, like, anytime that I am asserting my how I have been victimized, I am somehow diminishing the victimization of Meredith. And I push back against that constantly, and I to the point that I felt like I had to define a whole new bias about it. And I think that happens a lot in wrongful conviction cases, where there is this tendency for people to say, well, because the family of the original victim needs closure, we cannot explore the victimization of someone who has been accused.
Yeah, there's such a horrible paradox here that Saul Kassin has pointed out, and that's that being innocent, literally just being innocent, actually can put you at increased risk of not being seen as innocent. You know, you even making this point, some British tabloids would be like, "Oh, defensive Amanda."
Right.
So you almost can't win, right? Like, you know, it's like, what am I not supposed to defend my innocence?
Yeah.
You know, like I should just shut up.
Yeah.
You know, what's the alternative here? You know, that I just shut up. So, yeah, that's tough.
Yeah. Do you are you familiar? I'm. Do you know Saul Kassin? Because I know him personally.
He reached out to you when you were in jail.
Yeah, right? Yeah. He's a really great guy. And has done a tremendous amount to help me to process my experience, because what goes on in interrogation rooms was completely foreign to me, and he very much after sort of hearing me out what I experienced, shared his research with me, and I was just blown away. So anyway.
Well, thanks for telling me about his work, because I read some of his papers, found really interesting this paper he wrote on the psychology of confessions. Does innocence put innocence at risk? Mm. He said, recent research suggests that actual innocence does not protect people across a sequence of pivotal decisions. In pre-interrogation interviews, investigators commit false positive errors, presuming innocent suspects guilty. Naively believing in the transparency of their innocence, innocent suspects waive their rights. This is hard to say because there's a lot of innocence and innocence. Despite or because of their denials, innocent suspects elicit highly confrontational interrogations. This looks like textbook Amanda Knox, right? Like, oy vey.
Yeah. Yep. So, so grateful for his work.
Well, tell me about your keynote that you did at the American Psychology and Law Conference.
Oh, I mean, I am interested in how the question of why these things happen. And so when I'm invited to give a talk about this experience, I often will ask people like, well, what about this experience actually interests you? And looking at this, I was really happy to go to the Psychology and Law Conference because this is the part about wrongful convictions that I am most keen on. Like, why do, first of all, innocent people end up in this process, and how are these institutions sort of built not to not to like, I mean, Saul Kassin's research shows that there are lots of ways that innocent people are simply not accounted for, like in the interrogation room, where like if you make, if someone accuses you of something and you say, no, that's not what I did. Like the assumption is, oh, you're a guilty person who's lying and not that you're an actually innocent person. And so the ways that those coercive interrogation techniques, which are very, very effective at getting guilty people to confess to crimes, they're also very effective at getting innocent people to confess to crimes. But beyond that, I'm also interested in not just the psychology of the innocent person, but the psychology of the prosecutor and the detective and why it is that they end up honing in on the wrong person, not out of a sense of like, you know, outright evil or corruption, but out of a sense of like human fallacy. Because I, again, like when I think back to my prosecutor, I was never satisfied with the idea that, oh, this is happening to me just because bad people are doing bad things to me. Like, no, that's not what was happening. It was more complicated than that. And so I had to take into consideration, well, is there a kind of confirmation bias happening here? When the evidence finally came in that showed that it was Rudy Gadet and not me, was there a conservatism bias where they had made an already assumption about what the case was and they were only willing to tweak it just enough to accommodate a new set of information, but not to contradict their previous theory of the case? Like there are so many ways that, you know, even just the perception of me as a human being can be best explained. Like this ongoing perception of me as like a guilty person is due to the anchoring bias. The fact that the first piece of information that people have ever heard about me was that I was a guilty of a terrible crime. And so even when new evidence has come forth revealing that not to be the case, people are biased towards the first thing that they ever heard. And that explains a lot of the why of my experience. It doesn't really explain how to get out of it, but at least I have a better understanding of the human psychology behind my experience. Yeah.
Like I said, it's like you got a PhD in psychology through this whole situation. Yeah. You're referring to Giuliano Mignini.
Yes. Yeah, Giuliano Mignini.
Come on, Scott. You used to sing Italian opera. You can do better than that. Giuliano Mignini.
You actually did it really well. Most people are like, Giuliano, woo.
Maybe if I sing it, I'll do a better job.
Yeah.
But my take of this cat from watching the Netflix documentary is that he sees himself as the modern day Sherlock Holmes. You know, he's like, you know, he just had built up in his mind, you know, this whole like, I'm going to be the savior of the world. Like this is goes to your point you said earlier, you know, people that do bad things don't think in their head, oh, I'm doing a bad thing. They think mostly it's usually I'm doing something for the greater good. But there's a profound narcissism associated with a lot of those instances because you think in your head that you and only you are going to save the world. And that leads to hubris and that leads to overconfidence and that leads to subjectivity.
Yes.
Which is what happened a lot up the kazoo in your case, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But is there any chance for a reconciliation with him or?
Well, that's an intriguing question because it is something that I have been contemplating and pursuing for a long time. I can't say much about it, but just because it's an ongoing project. But it is something that is deeply important to me, the idea that I can basically confront my accuser and do so in a way that would be not antagonistic, but sort of restorative.
Well, good. I really look forward to hearing something about that.
Thanks. Yeah. And
good for you for, I mean, I'd like to see you talk to Rudy someday.
Yeah.
That would be incredible.
That would also be a very interesting experience. And I'm not
very emotional, I'm sure.
Yeah.
To say the least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's not ready for that one.
Yeah, I feel like I need a little more time for that one. Yeah,
absolutely. We're not going to be like, oh, no, we're bringing out Ruthie. <You know? laughs> ETL Drawer. Let's talk about ETL Drawer.
Love ETL Drawer. Yes,
I know. And look, I want to thank you so much for bringing to my attention these amazing, amazing researchers. Okay, so because you got me down rabbit holes, I was like, oh wow, the forensic science literature has some really serious problems.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
Really serious problems.
Yeah.
He said, I just want to quote something Itiel said, which I completely agree with. He said, there isn't a psychologist on this planet. He's referring to cognitive psychologists, which is what I am. There isn't a cognitive psychologist on this planet or any other planet who can come and say that judgment and perception are objective. It's one of the most basic cornerstones of psychology. Yet the more you start to look into the literature, you realize just how many of these techniques, like even fingerprinting analysis, have never actually been scientifically validated. Mm-hmm. They've been used for over 100 years, right? Mm-hmm. So my gosh, like that's insane, right? Yeah. Like that we assume that all these techniques are just completely objective and they don't involve bias when it turns out they very much do. And should we talk about one of the seminal studies that he conducted along those lines, where he showed that fingerprint analysts, when given anonymous prints from cases they themselves analyzed 10 years or so ago, they were asked to judge those same prints as a match or not. And when they were told that the suspect confessed, the results of their analysis often was in the opposite direction mm-hmm. of what they themselves had said about those very prints when they first analyzed them. That's shocking.
Yes. I hope that everyone sort of like followed that. So like DNA, yeah, or the fingerprint expert did a study many years ago, determined, you know, match or not match. Then many, many years later was confronted with the very same prints and came up with a very different result based upon being told that the person had confessed to the crime. So and this is why Saul Kassin's work is so important, because whether or not a person confesses is so, so biasing to people. People just can't wrap their minds around an innocent person confessing to a crime. So they assume that person now must be guilty. And even scientific experts are unable to separate their now bias in their own, objective looks at physical evidence. And so that's why Itiel Dror proposes a solution, which is linear sequential unmasking, where you only tell the forensic experts as much information as they need to know in order to do their job. The fingerprint expert doesn't need to know whether or not the suspect confessed or not in order to determine whether or not a fingerprint is a match. So just don't give them that biasing information. It's that simple.
Yeah, I mean, studies show possible error rates of 1% to 4% in fingerprint analysis errors and 10% or more in paint fiber and body fluid analysis alone. Mm-hmm. And then the more I dig into this, the more I realize all the problems with this. So here this is one quote I came across. You don't tell the crime lab scientists doing the DNA, for example, what the suspect's DNA profile looks like until they've extracted the DNA from the evidence profile for the victim first. I mean, it's like, duh, right? Yeah. You hear that, you're like, of course.
And yet that's not what the practice is.
Yeah, it's not what the practice is. Yeah. Lentini said that. Lentini. This kind of methodology also helps eliminate unwitting or unconscious bias towards linking evidence to a suspect. So there's so many things that bring in subjectivity into this. And these are real lives that we're talking about that are being wrongfully convicted.
And I think that it's important to note that, like, again, it's an unconscious bias that's impacting these experts and these detectives. Like, they're not knowingly and willingly making their lives easier and coming up with matches to the fingerprints because they heard someone confess. That just information unconsciously biased them to seeing results, objective results, very differently. And as a result, it is very, very important to not like to acknowledge that that's just the case. Like, it's not saying some kind of moral question about a forensic expert. It's just simply, this is a human problem. This is not a you or me problem. It's a human problem. And there's actually, are you familiar with the psychopath test by John Ronson? I mean, I'm sure you are.
Well, so absolutely. So one of the co-authors of the psychopath test is one of my co-authors on our late triad paper.
Oh,
so
great. Yeah.
He came over to the light side.
Cool. Yeah. One of my favorite jokes from that book is John Ronson said, as soon as I heard about confirmation bias, I started to see it everywhere.
Good. Yeah.
It's also so true. It is so true.
And motivated reasoning. Mm. You see motivated reasoning so much. There's a whole line of research. I'm writing an article right now for The Atlantic about this on moral tribalism and group narcissism and the extent to which we overlook the moral transgressions of people we see in our in-group. Mm-hmm. But if we have perceived them as being in our out-group, we will in ambiguous information, we'll see moral transgressions.
Absolutely.
So this is very important stuff. Yeah. Very important stuff. Do you still write poetry? Is that still in you?
So I have the most recent poetry that I have out in the world is a book of poems called The Cardio Tesseract that me and my husband wrote together. It's actually a kind of collection of.
He does poetry?
Oh, Chris does poetry.
Oh, he's literally a writer.
Two master's degrees in poetry kind of guy.
Sorry, that was a stupid question.
In our courtship would be reciting poems to me. Like, that's how it worked.
I'm sorry. I just forgot.
Cool. Okay. It's cool. You didn't know. Why would you know? So we're big poetry nerds. He, above all, is a huge poetry nerd and is constantly finding wonderful opportunities to share poetry with me. And he's not much of a singer. So with our daughter, like, I do a bunch of singing at her. He recites her poetry.
Love that. Yeah. I love that. As I told you earlier, I'm really interested in this field of post-traumatic growth. Mm. So I kind of want to leave with a question for you. Rabbi Harold Kushner, when he was reflecting on the death of his son, he said, quote, "I am a more sensitive person, a more effective pastor, a more sympathetic counselor because of Aaron's life and death than I would ever have been without it. Mm. And I would give up all those gains in a second if I could have my son back. Mm. If I could choose, I would forego all the spiritual growth and depth which has come my way because of our experiences. But I cannot choose." So one can always think, you know, in sort of the multiverse sort of thought experiment, what would Amanda Knox look, what would it be to, who would she be today if this experience didn't happen with her? But you can't choose that. No. And you'll never know. So moving forward, you know, what are some of the areas of growth that you're most excited about and that you think genuinely came about that wouldn't have come about if this didn't happen to you?
Thank you for asking that. And that makes me so sad. Also because it's like I'm a new parent, so I'm like newly appreciating like the depths of that sadness.
I'm really doing a great job making you cry today.
You are. You're just picking all the buttons. Very bad. So I think that my greatest, I mean, even just becoming more attuned to the suffering of others is something that I don't know that I had a good grasp on before all of this, because honestly, like I before everything happened in Italy, I lived a very, very blessed life. I did not have difficulties. My family was very close and very supportive. I had everything going for me. And I don't think I really understood the depths of loss and despair that human beings are capable of and routinely experience. And so it gave me a lot of compassion for people who experience that, and especially for people who experience that in a very public way and have that sort of extra dimension of suffering put on them by people perceiving them as and judging them while they are experiencing the worst experience of their lives. So that is something that I have a new sort of ingrained radar for and perspective on that I have found to be not just useful for myself, but also useful for people who reach out to me and feel really alone and isolated. There's like a special suffering when it comes to people who are not only experiencing tragedy or loss or trauma, but are being judged very publicly in the process. So
that's actually a really good point. Does this experience make you a little bit more skeptical when some people are tried in the court of public opinion?
Absolutely.
So when everyone else is jumping on someone, does it make you more sensitive?
Yes, 100%. Mm-hmm. And I hate the idea. Like, it really bugs me out, the idea that some quality that about yourself that you cannot control somehow makes it so that you aren't suffering. Like, what are we talking about? Like, no, everyone who is being judged for some dramatic thing is suffering, and period. So I don't know. It also, when people say things like, oh, cancel culture isn't real, I'm like, no, it is. Like, people are constantly trying to like sort of pin down people for like a one either real or imagined transgression and like define that person entirely by that thing. And and delete them, yeah. like literally cancel them. So I don't know. It's, yeah. it's, I feel like yeah. judgment in the public square is not treated with the amount of weight that it actually carries on the person who experiences it. Pile-on culture mm-hmm. is really real, and mob justice is often devoid of due process and proportional sentencing. And these are all reasons why we have a criminal justice system in the first place and don't just deal with transgressors out in the open. Like, there's a reason for that. And so, yeah, I am a firm believer that we should be way more cautious about the court of public opinion and have a lot more skepticism towards it.
Yeah, I very much agree. Well, it looks to me like the gestalt media narrative around you is changing. There seems to be something in the air, you know, the Rogan appearance, if, you know, the New York Times profile. In our conversation today, my goal was quite simply for you to just show who you are. Just show who you are. I didn't have to do anything. Like, yeah. you are who you are, and I wanted people to see that.
Yeah. Thanks.
And thank you. You strike me as someone who's very, very deeply empathetic, and I would even say, a poetic soul. Aww. Like, I feel like you have a poetic soul, thanks. Right? Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It does. The way that I interpret that is, I feel like I see a lot of beauty, even in the stuff that hurts, which is what I feel like a poet is constantly doing, is finding the beauty in the pain and not, you know, reveling in it, but just like acknowledging it. I feel like acknowledging is a really important part of my life now.
Yeah. So Viktor Frankl called that tragic optimism, is finding the beauty and meaning in tragedy. Mm. Thank you so much for coming to my podcast today, Amanda. And I hope you feel like you were seen. I hope you feel seen.
I totally feel seen today. Thank you very much. And you've given me a lot to think about, so I'll do that.
I'll send you some follow-up nerdy papers and things.
Yay.
Along the lines of what I talked about today.
Cool. Thanks.
All the best to you.
All right. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.